Like to do my last bit as my session chair, and so I'd like to introduce Dr. Lauren. I'm a little flushed off my piece.
Okay. So my name is Lauren Harsma. I teach at Calvin College, and my first two slides here are intended to give you a bit of context for where this particular bit of computer modeling comes in. So a lot of these discussions, there's talk about information and there's talk about complexity, and there's two ways to sort of get at this. And 3 years ago, I gave a talk on information, arguing, you know, there's natural processes can create many kinds of information and convert some types of information to another. And we can understand a lot about information. But I'm going to leave that aside, the information analysis, and focus on complexity. And here's a theological slide that I don't have repeated at the end of the talk, but try to remember this. This kind of gives a picture of what's motivating this, at least for me. Self-assembly to produce complexes which have capabilities far beyond the component pieces seems built into creation at lots of levels. Particles assemble into atoms, into molecules. Atoms assemble into stars and planets with oceans and air. Molecules, well, here's the big question mark, into autocatalytic cycles and life. Simple cells into more complex cells, and then to multicellular organisms, to ecosystems, sensing cells, to information processing brains. Some of these we have pretty good scientific understanding of. Some of them we don't. Some of them are big mysteries. Okay, in my opinion, it suggests a teleology. It tells us something about God's character and purpose. Now, some Christians look at this list and talk about self-assembly, that word self-assembly there, and they react with horror because it seems to make God too distant, and maybe the atheists win if these are all self-assembly. Other Christians, and I'm more in this camp, look at this kind of list and say, wow, if all those kinds of self-assembly are built in, that's amazingly cool design. And I want to understand how God did this. Now, maybe we can talk in Q&A about why we have these competing theological intuitions which seem to lead us in different directions. But for now, let's just say I'm in the second camp. And I chose to focus on the second most difficult one on this list. The origins of life is, of course, the most difficult, as Walter Bradley rightly points out. In my opinion, the second most difficult one, interesting to me, the one to say, now, how can divinely designed natural processes produce that self-assembly, is going from simple single-celled organisms to more complex ones with novel protein complexes doing things. In my opinion, probably the second. So, first definition, interlocking complexity or interdependence, I'll use both of those, multiple parts have to be present and working properly in order for the system to perform its functions. If certain single parts are removed, the entire system fails to perform its function at all, like clocks. So, what do I mean by self-organized interlocking complexity? It means the parts are not put in place by hand, by an external agent. Instead, from simpler initial conditions, the complex arrangement self-assembles over time as the parts interact. And there's lots of different ways that this can happen, but it's always hard to do. It's sort of well-suited to computer modeling. There's physics examples, biological examples, social sciences examples. I wanted to focus on protein complexes, and I wanted to do a computer model. So, evolving protein complexes with new functions and interlocking complexity. How can that happen? Well, if your model of biological evolution is something like it's sometimes portrayed in lower-level biology textbooks, one gene makes one protein has a single function, and mutations are point changes, which call small changes in functions. If that's what biological evolution was, I agree, you would not expect protein complexes with interlocking complexity and novel functions to evolve. They just wouldn't happen. Too improbable. All right, so if scientists do think that protein complexes, which display interlocking complexity and novel functions, evolve, how do they think they do it if it's not actually like that? Well, not just one way, but one of the more important ways, the one I wanted to explore, gene duplication, mutation, and co-option. And if you only remember one word from this talk, it's co-option, with or without the hyphen. That's the one. So for a co-option means essentially picking up a new function. So one way this could happen, suppose you have gene duplication and then mutation in the new gene, the duplicated gene, and that mutation could produce a new function. While you still have the old function of the original gene, the new gene, new function, mutated, could have a new function. But that's not the only way. You could have an existing genes and proteins with certain functions, and the mutations elsewhere in the genome could suddenly say, ah, we can interact with this existing protein, which already has a function, but now we can interact with it too, and it can pick up a new function. So we're getting around the idea that proteins only have single functions. And here's one of my favorites. Changes in the environment can lead to functions without any changes in the genome at all. Now, here think about an organismal level. Think about a species with a range of phenotypic features, like, say, beak sizes in some environment. And then part of the environment changes, opening up a new food source. And now the beak has certain functions, but for certain members of the species who have particular shapes, it can actually pick up a new function having to do with a new food source while still having all the old functions. So the genome didn't change at all, but it picked up new functions because of a change in the environment. Well, I wanted to build a model that would sort of, since evolutionary biologists think all of these things can happen and have happened, I wanted to build a model that could sort of explore them all. But the problem is, okay, so they're evolutionary biologists think that they're really important, but fairly rare events in the history of life, so how can we study them systematically? I'm thinking, well, let's try a computer model. One of my students suggested PyKaryotes for the Python programming language. So let's go through this. Here's what we designed. Our PyKaryotes are digital organisms. They gather chemicals from an environment. They have genomes, which are strings of codons. They make proteins from strings of gathered chemicals, the chemicals they gather. The proteins sometimes combine into complexes. And after a certain amount of genome reading time, the fitness of the organism is calculated based on the chemicals gathered. And the fitness determines reproductive probability, and mutations can happen. Well, you can see how this is inspired by biology. These are abstract organisms, abstract digital, but all of these elements of real biology are in our model. All right, so codons. In this case, codons are numbers like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, which refer to chemicals in the environment. A codon 0 is the default. It means gather. So when it reads a chemical 0, a codon 0, it says, okay, I'm in gather mode. So any subsequent 1, 2, 3, or 4 means gather chemical, that chemical from the environment. Codon minus 1 means for the next two codons, don't gather, instead move towards a higher concentration of that. Although in this early version of the model, we didn't implement motion. So none of the subsequent data has motion in the model, but we have it in, we have that capability built in. Minus 2 means build a protein. So it means for the next 5, actually I think for the rest of the, it's actually 8. That's a number we can change in our model. But for the next 5 or the next 8 codons, when you read a 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, don't gather that chemical. Instead, take your existing stores of that chemical and string them together to make a protein, say protein 5, 3, 2, 2, 3, 1. Okay, that's the protein you make. All right. Now, what about these proteins? So the organisms gather up some chemicals, and then they read in their codon that they're supposed to make a protein. So they make some proteins. They string together some chemicals. It's a protein. Most of them have no function. It's a programmable parameter. Some are functional, and by functional, I mean they speed up the organism's ability to gather one chemical. So the first time a protein is made by any organism in our model, its functionality or lack of function is randomly determined. And if a new protein is only a few point mutations away from an existing protein, it's assigned to the same family with the same function. But if it's several mutations away, then we say, well, it's a different family, it has a different function. Then there's protein complexes. So proteins can bind together into complexes of 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Most proteins don't bind with each other. Some of them do bind into complexes. Most complexes are not functional. So you can have a functional protein and another functional protein, and they bind together into a complex that's not functional. That can happen. But some are functional, and here's where we make it interesting. The function of a protein, if a protein speeds up the gathering of a chemical, a protein of complex size 3, which might have 0, 1, 2, or 3 non-functional proteins as part of it, whatever a protein function does, a complex of size 3 will have that function to the third power, so it'll really speed up gathering. So that's how complexes can become particularly good. And again, complexes function or lack a function are randomly determined when new complexes evolve. And protein complex families are composed of proteins of the same family. All right, so what our organisms do is, after 10,000 codon reads, reading of their DNA codon, the organism's fitness is calculated based on how many chemicals it gathered. And then there's a cost, a fitness cost, based on the size of the genome. An organism can reproduce 0, 1, 2, or more times based on its fitness, and mutations can happen. Point mutations can happen, but we also added genome doubling, gene copying, gene deletion, and horizontal transfer. All right, so what kind of organisms are these most like in real life? In my opinion, the real life organisms these are most like would be single-celled organisms, which specialize in finding a food source, reproducing really fast until that food source rises up, competing with other organisms that are trying to eat it up real fast until the food source sort of peters out, and then they sort of go to a spore-like stage and spread out and sort of go into stasis until they find a new food source, settle down, and start reproducing really fast. Such organisms exist. And how could such organisms develop evolve novel protein complexes with novel functions to take advantage of new food sources? That was through co-option. That's what we wanted to investigate. All right. So, now in all the subsequent graphs, on the horizontal axis is the generation number. So the first, second, third, fourth, fifth generation of the organism. Now what we see when we set our parameters in certain ranges for all these different adjustable parameters in the model, over time, it's typical, but not always, that the fitness of the organisms rises over time. And the genome length. Now you'll see there's an initial drop in genome length because there's a cost of the genome. So when you don't have any functional proteins, you want as small a genome as possible. But then some event happens where there's a genome doubling followed by mutation to make a functional protein, and suddenly there's an advantage to having a bigger genome, and that happened in this particular run sometime after the 220th generation. There was a functional protein, and then another, and then another, and then it took off. So genome length grew over time as fitness grew over time. Complexity and interlocking complexity. Now, complexity means what's the size of a typical complex involved in gathering chemicals? So, of course, it starts out with zero. Initially, the organisms don't have any functional proteins. Eventually, they start inventing functional proteins and then functional complexes of size 2, 3, and 4. Interlocking complexity is a measure of how many times do you have pieces where you remove a piece and the whole thing falls apart. So a protein complex of size 5 with 2 functional proteins and 3 non-functional proteins in our particular thing is said to have an interlocking complexity of 3. So this is 5 different plots of proteins of size, complexes of size 1. You see initially they're not used at all. Around generations 2, all of a sudden there's a lot of functional proteins of size 1. But eventually over time, at least half the proteins are not functional because they're being incorporated into complexes of size 2, 3, 4, and ultimately 5 as you get up to generation 1000. Now this is a different kind of graph. This is the sum of 100 runs, actually the sum of the central 60 of 100 runs averaged together as we vary one of our parameters. So this is where our model's really starting to do some work. The gene duplication rate. So what is the probability that an organism will have gene duplication event happen during reproduction? Well, what you can see is the top curve is where we set the gene duplication rate really high, and the bottom curve is where we set the gene duplication really low. So not surprisingly, if gene duplication rates are high, complexity evolves quickly. You get the complexity 4 and 5 in just a few hundred generations, whereas when the gene duplication rate is set really low, that's the lowest curve, it takes thousands of generations to even get up to complexity 1. Gathering speed. The more quickly that organisms can gather chemicals, the more quickly they can evolve. When a baseline gathering speed is really slow, what happens is organisms have a disadvantage if they're trying to build proteins, because they're reading along their genome and it says, okay, now for the next section of the genome, build a protein, but it hasn't gathered enough chemicals yet to do that. So it's wasting time trying to build a protein when it shouldn't be. That's what happens when it has trouble getting resources. Now in this graph, we see when protein, what's the probability that a protein is functional? If we set that to 1, the highest curve, complexity develops really fast. If we set that to the lowest value, 0.003, complexity never develops. And then for in-between values, you can see slower and faster development. Now this is yet one more kind of graph. It asks, how many generations does it take to reach complexity level 4 as we adjust one of our parameters in our model? So in this case, what's the probability that a protein is functional, the same as the previous graph? You can see if on this side, the right side of the graph, you reach complexity 4 really fast if all complexes are functional. If you set it too low, then you never reach complexity 4. The functional strength. The more functional strength a protein has, the better it is at multiplying chemical gathering, the faster you reach reach complexity 4. But if you set protein functionality really low, like it only doubles the speed of gathering, it takes tremendously long time. We cut off the simulation after a certain number of generations because it just wasn't developing complexity. Protein family. This is one that several people have talked about, including Doug Axe. If it only takes a few mutations to make a new function, as you can see in this model, you get complexity developing quickly. But if it takes many mutations, in this case 7 out of a possible protein size of 8, if it takes 7 mutations before you run a new family, it takes much longer to develop complexity. And this one's my favorite, the point mutation rate. The point mutation rate, mostly in this part of the graph, if the point mutation rate is high, complexity develops quickly. As the point mutation gets slow to the left side of the graph, complexity develops slowly. But if the point mutation is too high, way at the right end of the graph, all of a sudden complexity doesn't evolve. What's happening there is good proteins are mutating into non-functional proteins before functional complexes can evolve. So we put this all together. What we see in our model, and I think this is relevant to biology, is evolution of complexity is speeded up by high gene duplication rates, high point mutation rates, high protein binding probability, protein probability size, small protein family size. Now, what slows down evolution of complexity? Well, let's flip those all around. Low gene duplication rates, low point mutation rates, low protein binding probability, large protein family size, all will slow down the evolution of complexity. But here's a few new ones. I don't have a graph for this, but we did do the study. If selection pressure is too weak, what happens is complexity doesn't evolve. Baseline chemical gathering speeds are too small. I did show this one. Complexity doesn't evolve. If the genome fitness length is too high, complexity doesn't evolve because you over-favor really small organisms with really tiny genomes. Well, you can't evolve complexity if your genome is tiny. And if the point mutation rate is too high, again, evolution of complexity is inhibited. So, in the end, where we have it right now, our model is working as we hoped, and the initial results, this list of what makes complexity evolve and speed up and slow down, isn't surprising, and I think it's actually helping us clarify our understanding. And here's where I really want to go with this. What happens if we start introducing competition for limited resources, resources distributed unevenly in the environment, and sudden environmental changes? That's where I think a lot of the more interesting stuff, because right now, what our model has done for us is given us results which don't surprise us based with sort of just thinking about what's going on with biology. Now, one of the real questions I want to ask, which I think is relevant to real biology, is under what conditions are sudden changes in the environment likely to promote evolution of novelty and complexity, and under what conditions are sudden environmental changes likely to inhibit the evolution of complexity? And I don't have good intuition on the end of that question. I think the model might actually help us with that. So that's the model, and I showed you earlier the slide which sort of gave the context in the larger scientific and theological picture of why we're interested in God creating a system where novelty and complexity can evolve by understandable scientifically understandable mechanisms. All right, I'm ready for questions. Yes?
Please add a word about the measure of complexity. There were two graphs. One showed the maximum 3. There was another one showed the maximum 5.
Yes. So there is not a well-accepted definition of protein, of complexity of a genome. So for our model, we had to come up with something. So we chose the complexity of an organism to be the average size of the protein or complex which is used to gather materials. So a complexity of 1 could mean that of all the chemicals in the environment, everyone is gathered by a protein complex of size 1. Or maybe some of them of size 0 and some of them of size 2, but it averages to 1. And then eventually you get up to 4, 4.5, 5, which means every organism that's alive is gathering gathering materials from the environment using protein complexes of size 4 or size 5. Interlocking complexity has to do with the question, I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact definition that's in our paper. I have to look up our paper. But it has to do with the fraction of those proteins which have absolutely no function on their own. So a complex of size 5 with 3 proteins with no function whatsoever on their own, but if you remove them, the whole complex goes away, would have interlocking complexity of 3. I think that's how we defined it. And in some of our models, what happens is all the organisms wind up with complexity 5 and interlocking complexity of 5, which means they're gathering all their materials using complexes where none of the proteins have functions on their own, but they have this interlocking complexity of 5. Yes.
I'm curious, in real biology, I just don't know, how many proteins in a complex, you know, machine actually don't have a function? Is that, no?
That's a good question. I really don't know. There's one example I do know. I do electrophysiology, so ion channels. There are these, some ion channels are made of 4 or 5 identical copies of the same protein. But there are other ion channels where they're made of, say, 2 copies of one gene, and or one protein, and 1 copy of another protein, and 1 copy of another protein, and 1 copy of another protein. And if you get rid of all but one of them, if you try and make a protein out of just all copies of the same, it really doesn't work well at all. So in some of these ion channels, it's like one of them would be functional on its own, and 3 of them are not, and then there's always some other associated ones that are purely on the inside of the cell, which modulate the channel. And whether they have other functions in the cell or not, I really don't know. I don't think it is known. So in ion channels, it's not unusual to have something that requires 6 or 7 or 8 proteins, only one of which could be functional without any of the others. But that's just one example out of many in itself. So it's a good question. And I think that's a very wide open area of research. Yes, Walter.
Or I understand this is illustrative and to look at kind of a parametric study.
Yes.
And see what you can learn from that. Do you have any sense of is there enough empirical or experimental data out there to know whether the input parameter ranges you're looking at and so forth have some correlation with reality or not? Because being in the right space, so to speak, could give you better answers than if you happen to be in some odd space that doesn't correspond to.
Very good question. The parameters that we could set to be biologically realistic and still have reasonable computational times, we did. Point mutation rates, gene duplication rates, genome doubling rates, those sorts of things. Yeah, exactly. Now, protein length is obviously wrong because 8 amino acids is not a protein. A real protein is 100, 200, 300 amino acids, and that would just slow our system down to a crawl. And as for protein functional probabilities, I'm sure that's a big question mark. How many, out of all possible amino acid sequences, what's functional? There's a little bit of literature on that. We tried to sort of hit it in there. But yeah, that's one where we got as realistic as we could, but we know that it probably depends on the protein family, how far you can go away and still be functional. And functional in this context, in these organisms, we didn't try to simulate the entire cellular machinery that makes duplication and homeostasis possible. We only simulated the portion of the genome that had to do with the gathering of food. And we ignored the rest because, again, computational time. Yes?
Laura, I've got a question that any four of you could weigh in on, but kind of curious. From somebody who's coming from outside of your specific field, I hear Walter talk, and the takeaway message is intelligence is required. And I hear Randy's talk, and the takeaway message is no intelligence is required. I hear James talk, and the takeaway message is intelligence is required. I hear your talk, and the takeaway message is no intelligence is required.
Yes.
And you mentioned Doug Axe as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, is there a meaningful way that we as committed Christians can move forward in a positive way on this without saying you guys got to give it up and just come to our camp?
Yes.
You know, I went to the Discovery Institute last summer, visited with Doug Axe, and I visited with Dennis Venema of the Trinity Western. And I'm trying to see, how can these guys, they're both committed Christians, can possibly, you know, work together in a positive way?
I've actually given a lot of thought on that. Again, I brought this up because I talked about theological intuitions. In my experience, some Christians have a theological intuition that it would be really good to find some elements on this list which sort of point to direct divine action in biological history or the history of the natural world. And for other Christians, that sounds like appallingly bad design, given the whole sort of picture. And what can I say? The way forward is to admit that these are theological intuitions. Our base theology, as Walter said so well at the beginning, is God could have done it anywhere. And I fully agree. Let's look at molecules to life. Theologically, I'm perfectly fine with God doing it miraculously or God doing it through natural processes. Walter said the same thing. So the way forward is to say we agree on that base theology. We agree that we perhaps have different competing theological intuitions or desires, but that ultimately the science will let us decide, and we'll take the science as it comes. And I think while Walter and I have disagree about where we think the origin of life will end up, we agree about the base theology. We agree that science will let us decide, and that's, I think, the way to go forward. And Walter agrees. All right.
Well said.
Yes. Not that particular book.
Okay.
I've heard of his work, but
and his work is in transposons, and he basically came up under McClintock from the 50s, and he uses transposons and other things from the 50s and say, hey, mutation hasn't produced novelty,
Let's look at epigenetics and how transposons, et cetera, cause methylation from in the DNA. So the DNA is not a read-only mechanism. It is a read-write affected from the external. And he uses the immune system to start in on that, saying our immune system is highly variable, and it goes on from there. Any thoughts about epigenetics, or would this even fit in?
Yes, I think epigenetics becomes, I think every one of these steps of self-organization is somewhat different from all the others. And going from simple single-celled organisms to single-celled organisms with greater genomic complexity, which I put in blue here, has some of the mechanisms, the primary mechanisms, but not the only mechanisms, I think are probably the ones I'm trying to model. But going to multicellular life and developing novelty in once you have multicellular life, is probably going to involve mostly other kinds of mechanisms than this. This will still play some role, the co-option. But I think epigenetics will have a much bigger role there. Since I know less about epigenetics than co-option, I chose to leave that out of my model. So my thinking is multicellular organism is where that is probably a larger portion of the story. And the stuff I talked about will be less a part of the story when you get to multicellular organisms. That's my intuition. I don't know if that's true. Yes?
I love your model. It's really fun. I like how it reinforced the nature of the genetic code, the degeneracy, and the conservation of codon choices, because if you got that mutation rate too high, bad things happen. I have a question. Can you modify your code to account for endosymbiosis, like Lynn Margulies?
We could model it to produce multicellular. I could imagine modifying this code so that these organisms would affect each other and sort of go to slime mold kind of thing, or endosymbiosis, or things like that. Probably that's not the first thing we'll do. Probably the first thing we'll do is we'll add in variable environments without having organisms have the possibility to connect to each other. So right now, these organisms are completely unable to affect each other. Well, that's not quite right. We have a portion of the code we haven't turned on, which lets them produce poisonous chemicals, dump them in the environment, which have bad effects on others. It's in the code. We haven't turned it on yet. So chemical warfare between them is something we kind of had in mind that we wanted to be able to turn on at some point and haven't done it yet. Yes?
Do you plan to release the software code at some point or distribute it?
Yes. The plan is I'm waiting for a collaborator to approve a draft, and then we'll send it off, and then will it get accepted for publication? I don't know. As soon as it gets accepted for publication, we are going to put the code publicly accessible, along with the student programmers have made nice little pages to explain how to modify the code and so forth. We want people to play with it. We don't want to hold on. We want to give it out freely. Yeah. Yes?
Do you look at the spore code by
yes.
Spores? This strikes me as parallel.
Yes.
Similar.
Yes. I looked at about a dozen different artificial life codes out there to make sure that we could gather some cool insights, but we weren't duplicating anybody's work. And the spore code, in terms of co-option to produce interlocking complexity, there's none that do it exactly. There are some interesting ones that have evolution of, I think this is a Samford University group, evolution of digital elements to produce logic gates that would come the closest to this. But the spore is really cool. They got cool stuff going on. And they're interested in slightly different questions, but related questions to what we are. But yeah, that's a cool one. Yes?
I didn't really test this. Are your organisms depleting their environment?
Wonderful question. In all the results I showed, no, but we can easily turn it on. It's in our model that we can turn on limited resources.
That would make them influencing each other immediately.
Exactly. Without even having chemical warfare, simply by speed for limited resources, they'd be exerting influence on each other. Yep, absolutely. That's why it's part of the model.
Well, let's say thanks to Lauren, and thank you for coming to the session.